Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Greetings and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Patty James, Vice Chair of the Club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and Chair of this program. It's my pleasure to introduce you to these four esteemed panelists. And we're here today to talk about Thea Singer's Wall Street Journal's Top 5 Wellness Books of 2010. Her book is Stress Less, The New Science That Shows Women and Men, by the way, How to Rejuvenate the Body and Mind. Thea grew up in New Jersey and graduated from Northwestern with a degree in English literature and went on to do pre-med studies while working full-time as an editor at the Boston Phoenix. Thea has written articles about health and science for more than three decades. She's been a dance critic since 1985 and is fascinated by the place where art, science, and human interest meet. Her byline has appeared in newspapers such as the Washington Post, the Boston Globe, the Boston Herald, and The Nation. Thea is a contributor to Scientific American, More, The Oprah Magazine, Natural Health, Body and Soul, and TechnologyReview.com. Thea has been a publisher in residence at Emerson College and a fellow at the American Dance Festival Critics Conference. Currently, she teaches, as if that's not enough, Thea, at MIT as an instructor in the Writing Across the Curriculum program. She lives in Brookline, Massachusetts with her husband, Henry Satoru, and daughter Sophie Rose, and Tibetan Terrier Pretzel. Alyssa Appel, PhD, health psychologist at UCSF. Alyssa Appel obtained her PhD in psychology from Yale University and is currently an associate professor at the UCSF Department of Psychiatry. She is also a faculty member in the Health Psychology Postdoctoral Program, the Osher Center for Integrative Medicine, the Robert Wood Johnson Health and Society Postdoctoral Scholars Program, and a leader of the UCSF Center on Obesity Assessment, Study, and Treatment. That's the acronym is COAST. Her primary study is on family caregivers and attempts to understand from a psychobiological and genetic perspective why some people are vulnerable and others resilient to the chronic stress of caregiving. She collaborates with Drs. Elizabeth Blackburn and Xu Lin to understand how stress can affect the telomerase maintenance system. With her collaborator, she is also involved in trials examining effects of stress reduction on immune system aging and HIV and on fat distribution. In 2005, she was awarded the Neil Miller New Investigator Award and APA Health Psychology Award for demonstrating novel links between stress and stress arousal with markers of cellular aging. Calvin Harley, PhD, pioneer in telomere biology, UCSF. Calvin Harley, PhD, is president and scientific officer of Telome Health Incorporated, a molecular diagnostic company focused on leveraging telomere biology for health monitoring, disease risk, and drug response. Prior to THI, Dr. Harley was chief scientific officer and vice president research of Geron Corporation until 2009, where he and his team successfully moved drugs based on telomerase into clinical trials. Dr. Harley received his education at Waterloo University and McMaster University, where he obtained his PhD in biochemistry. Dr. Harley has published extensively on medical applications for telomere research. He is an inventor on foundational patents related to telomere biology, telomerase, aging, and the diagnosis and treatment of disease. He enjoys summer camping in the summer and winter with his family and friends in the Sierra Nevada mountains. Xu Lin, PhD, graduated from Fudan University in Shanghai, China in 1992, and she then went on to Cornell University for her PhD. She joined Dr. Elizabeth Blackburn's lab for her postdoctoral training in 1999. In 2003, she, together with Dr. Elizabeth Blackburn, Dr. Alyssa Appel, pioneered the work on psychological stress and telomere and telomerase activity. She personally developed telomerase activity assays to measure this enzymatic activity in human immune cells, which merged as a bioaging marker from the pioneer work she, Dr. Blackburn, and Dr. Appel did. She also adopted and optimized the telomere length measurement technique in the Blackburn Lab. She serves currently as a project manager in the Blackburn Lab for dozens of collaborations to study telomere maintenance and health. Her work with Drs. Blackburn and Appel was featured in major news media, including CBS 60 Minutes, National Geographic, Time Magazine, and the San Francisco Chronicle. Wow. Welcome. Thank you for being here. So I'm going to ask questions, and then we'll do a Q&A afterwards for the questions that you may have. So, Thea, tell us, there's lots of books about stress out there. So what makes your book unique?
There are a lot of books about stress out there. There are also a lot of articles. We've been hearing about stress forever, how stress can make us sick. Stress has been connected with everything from gastrointestinal diseases to cardiovascular diseases to immune system dysfunction. And this is all really important research, and it's really important for us to pay attention to it. But what I wanted to investigate, and this grew out of the work of Alyssa Epple and Liz Blackburn and Zhu Lin, I wanted to look at how stress can actually make us old. And what we're talking about is not just that it contributes to diseases of aging, but that it actually contributes to our very aging physiologically all the way down to our cells. And that's what really turned me on and that I wanted to investigate.
Great. Thank you. Alyssa, what are telomeres and telomerase, and how do they relate to aging?
So in all the cells in our body, we have our chromosomes contain our genetic code, and these genes determine the whole readout for all the proteins that are made in our body. So it's very important that they're protected. And at the tips of the chromosomes are the telomeres. So there are caps that protect the genetic material from damage. They're like keeping the doors closed tightly so that no damaging chemicals and molecules can get in and cause problems with our DNA. Mutations, fusions, breakages, things would be very bad if we didn't have our telomeres. So as we age, our telomeres shorten with time. You might think of them like the aglets, the tips of our shoelaces, and these kind of wear down and fray as time goes on. So what happens when telomeres get too short? This can cause catastrophic events for the cell. The cells age, they can't do their jobs, they get senescent, which is this state of being old but not quite dying yet, rather wreaking some havoc in our cells. So when the cell gets senescent, it starts becoming pro-inflammatory and secretes cytokines into our blood. And that can make our whole body, we can have systemic inflammation. And I think of inflammation as inflamm aging. It's one of the major factors that's aging our body. So how do we protect ourselves from telomere shortening over time? Luckily, there is telomerase. Telomerase is an enzyme that was discovered in the 1980s by our colleague Elizabeth Blackburn and her lab. She got the Nobel Prize for this discovery last year. And telomerase is the solution to that telomere shortening that we have every year. Telomerase is this amazing enzyme that sits on the ends of our chromosomes near the telomeres and rebuilds them, actually can lengthen our telomeres. So thank goodness for telomerase. We're going to talk a lot about telomerase today and how we can maintain our telomerase and how we might even be able to increase our telomerase.
Thank you. Calvin, why is telomere length more useful for health monitoring or disease risk assessment than other markers?
And, well, we basically think that telomere length may be the single best global marker of health and disease risk. Most other markers actually address usually a single system or disease. Blood pressure, for example, or cholesterol relate mainly to cardiovascular health, and PSA relates mainly to prostate health and prostate cancer. Moreover, many of these other markers actually are just that, markers. They aren't causal factors in the disease. Prostate-specific antigen by itself doesn't do much clinically, but it is a marker of potential risk for prostate cancer. On the other hand, short telomeres are a global assessor. They integrate many different factors and give us a better feeling of our global health and global disease risk. And in addition, a lot of studies in humans and in animal models have shown that critically short telomeres are a causal factor in disease. Basically, all of the stem cell compartments in our body, which are responsible for rejuvenating tissue, whether it's the bone marrow, aspects of the immune system coming from the bone marrow, the liver, the lungs, the skin, for example, are dependent upon the enzyme telomerase that Dr. Eppel mentioned. That telomerase is higher generally in those systems. And if it weren't for the ability of these cells to divide more than normal, our systems would fail much earlier. So looking at telomere length and what actually is causing telomeres to shorten can give us a better assessment of what our health status is and maybe what we can do about it.
Thank you. Chu, is telomere length inherited?
Yes, telomere length is inherited, and as you might have guessed, many genes will influence telomere length. For example, in Baker's yeast, it's known that over 350 genes have been shown to affect telomere length, and that's over 5% of the number of genes that yeast has. Now, in humans, geneticists have compared telomere length in twins, and they found that, depending on the study, between 30 to 70% of telomere length is inherited. So that leaves between 30 to 70% of the telomere length actually affected by environment, either a shared environment in the twin household or unique environment. Another approach that geneticists use to examine telomere length, the genetics of telomere length, is look at common variants in human genome, and these are called single nucleotide polymorphism. People also call them SNPs, and several SNPs have been found to be associated with telomere length, and they are found. Some of them are actually within genes that we know are involved in telomere length. For example, the RNA component of the telomeres that Dr. Eppel was mentioned. And others, we don't know how they are mechanistically influence telomere length. Now, the exciting thing is that Dr. Blackburn's lab is currently measuring telomere length for over 100,000 samples from Kaiser Permanente patients. And for these same patients, whole genome SNP analysis will be determined. So after completion of this big project, we will be able to examine the telomere length association with the genetics in more detail and with a lot more people. So,
Thea, you talk about food stress and telomeres in your book. Why do we eat when we're stressed, and are there foods we can eat to reduce stress?
That we eat when we're stressed is an evolutionary necessity. I actually just recently wrote an article for Huffington Post about this. Who remembers Oprah and her eating those tubs of mac and cheese when her film Beloved tanked? This was she was interviewed by Piers Morgan. I didn't see the interview, but I heard about it, and she talked about how she was so depressed, so stressed, that she said to her chef, "I want buckets of mac and cheese." And it's not unusual, and really it was like 30 tons. It was huge, and it's not unusual. 30 pounds, I mean, excuse me. 30 pounds. Oh, Oprah, she's trying to lose weight. Anyway, the fact that we go and we eat when we're stressed is, it's built into our systems, and this is why. When we're stressed, the first phase of stress is called fight or flight. And when that happens, certain systems shut off and certain systems get revved up. For instance, digestion shuts down. No need to be really dealing with digestion right now. Reproduction shuts down. We're not talking about having new kids right now. But what you need to have really alert is your brain has to be really on fire, so that if there's a threat out there that you have to take care of, that you have to either fight or flee from, that you're really revved up and alert. Glucose, the simplest sugar, has to go to your thigh so you can run after, you know, that moose you're trying to slay on the tundra. You can run home so that you're safe from it. So there are certain systems that go on and certain systems that go off. This is good stress. This is acute stress. Now, what happens after the stressor has passed is that it's time to replenish those glucose stores. It's time to replenish the fuel. And so that's why we eat. And we're driven to eat fatty kind of sweet foods because those release the glucose more quickly, and they also act as a kind of natural tranquilizer. We get ourselves into trouble these days because we're not talking about physical stressors. We're talking largely about mental stressors. We're sitting in a traffic jam. We're not using up any energy. We're obsessing about something. But our bodies don't know the difference. They're still acting as if we're out on that tundra trying to slay that moose. And so the system has gone essentially haywire. And so even though we don't really need to replenish those energy stores, our bodies think we need to, and so we eat. And what happens also is that glucocorticoids, cortisol is in humans the primary stress hormone. It sets off the reward center in our brains. It's the same center that's set off by drugs of abuse, not to the same degree, of course. And so dopamine, the neurotransmitter dopamine, is released in the brain. Dopamine makes us want things. It's a motivator. And what dopamine also does is it makes us go out and seek something to satisfy that want. And then we find this palatable food that's so easily at hand these days everywhere you look, and so that's a way that we satisfy that wanting, and the sweet fatty foods kick off another system called the opioid system, and that determines liking. And so we have this wanting and this liking happening at once, and we think that we're really kind of evening things out. We're in a state of equilibrium. But in fact, what happens is that we're calmed for a very short period of time, and then the wanting starts up again. So we eat more of the fatty stuff. We eat more of mac and cheese the way Oprah did, and then we want even more of it. So it becomes a kind of never-ending cycle. There aren't that many foods out there that actually do relieve stress, but there have been some studies showing a few of them that do. One of them, surprisingly, is pistachio nuts, a study done by Sheila West. At Penn State University, she did a study, and she found that what pistachio nuts do is they relieve vascular stress. So if you're experiencing a stressor, your vascular system is going to be less reactive if you've been eating pistachio nuts, and this will lead to lower blood pressure and also to lower bad cholesterol. To tie in the reduction of stress with the slowing of aging, with the telomere story, there are some foods that we don't know that it's necessarily a cause and effect relationship. But there was one study also done at UCSF where the scientist was looking at men, and this is why the book is not just for women. That was the publisher's idea. He was looking at men with stable cardiac disease. And it was a 5-year study, and he found that over this period of time, over this 5 years, some of the men's telomeres actually lengthened. And he said, I wonder what the variable could be. What is driving this? So he did a very exhaustive analysis. He thought maybe it was statins. He thought maybe it was aspirin. He looked at physical exercise, level of education. And the one thing that he found that was different was that those whose telomeres had lengthened had higher levels of omega-3 fatty acids in their blood than those who hadn't. There was also a study that found that women who took a multivitamin had longer telomeres than those who were not taking a daily multivitamin. So there are certain foods out there that can make a difference. And as a final word, I just want to say, it's not only what you eat, it's the way you eat that can really help to reduce stress. That's and next. If you want to investigate that a little, you can look at Jean Christeller's site for the Center for Mindful Eating.
And that's a perfect segue to the next question for Alyssa. You have done considerable research on stress reduction. So what have you found so far in your stress reduction interventions? And I think that was, you know, Thea just touched on that a little bit. But what have you found?
Well, most of our interventions are underway. But I can tell you about two that have been published and then an unpublished study that I'm most excited about. So one of our collaborations with Elizabeth Blackburn, Julin, our UCSF group, we worked with Dean Ornish, and he had a group of men with prostate cancer who followed his very low-fat diet with a lot of antioxidants like in food sources, fresh fruit and vegetables. And in his program, they also have a lot of stress reduction. They have some group support, meditation, yoga. And at the end of 3 months, we saw a significant increase in the telomerase activity in their white blood cells. So that was the first study, and that was very exciting. And the more they decreased in their stress, a lot of intrusive thoughts about having prostate cancer, the men who really improved on those intrusive thoughts had the highest increases in their telomerase. So recently we did a study on meditation and telomerase to see if really changing our well-being and stress levels through intensive meditation might increase telomerase. This was a collaboration with Cliff Sarin and Tonya Jacobs at UC Davis. This is the most intensive meditation study ever. They recruited a group of people away to a mountain in Colorado and a perfectly matched control group, and they had them do this meditation retreat for 3 months of their life. And what we found in that study was that the meditation group compared to this well-matched weightless group had significantly higher telomerase, 30% higher. And when we looked to see, well, what changes were related to this high telomerase, we found that on almost every scale of psychological well-being, the people who improved the most had the highest telomerase. And in particular, feelings of purpose in life and feelings of well-being and positive affect were related to the higher telomerase. So it's not necessary that you go meditate on a mountain for 3 months, but rather increases in these aspects of well-being might be activating the cellular enzyme to increase. So that was exciting to see as well. In a current study, we're still analyzing, so I'd call this preliminary, don't cite it. We call this the Peter Bauman study. We had 250 women come in, and we measured their telomere length, and a really pretty long battery of the different aspects of lifestyle and psychological well-being that we thought would be related to telomere length. And this was kind of a horse race. We want to know, well, if we measure everything at once, what's really most related to telomere length? What's kind of taking all the variance here? And what we found in that study was that it wasn't our typical scales of perceived stress, but actually state of awareness. And what I mean by that is the people who endorsed the item of being really present in the moment and very focused and engaged in what they were doing had longer telomeres. And in contrast, people who were not in the moment but didn't had a lot of mind wandering. They didn't want to be where they were at the moment. That was related to shorter telomeres. So that was very interesting. So I think it really makes us ask the question of where are you right now? Where is your mind? Are you paying attention to your life, to the person you're with, to what you're doing? Or are you living kind of in the past or the future?
Zhu, some of your research focuses on the role of environmental, biochemical, and lifestyle factors on telomeres. We just discussed food and lifestyle factors. Now, what environmental factors affect our telomere length?
When we say environmental factors, I speak of it in a broad sense. So first, we can think of the social environment people are in. I can give you a few examples. So we know that from our study and others, socioeconomic status is found to be associated with telomere length. For example, people who do manual work versus non-manual work have shorter telomere length. In another study that's done in Hong Kong, men who have self-report high ranking in society have longer telomere length than men who self-report social ranking is low. And also, unemployment is associated with shorter telomere length. Higher education level is related to longer telomere length. So another example is from our work together with Dr. Janice Humphreys at UCSF is to look at women who experienced interpartner violence. We found that these women have shorter telomere length compared to the controls, and the length in this relationship and having children in this relationship are related to having shorter telomere length. And I can give you another example is childhood trauma and adverse events. We found that childhood trauma in terms of physical, emotional neglect or abuse are all related to shorter telomere length when we look at them as adults.
Interesting. Calvin, I'm afraid this is a three-part question. Can telomere length change? What causes the change? And what is more important, my telomere length today or how it changes over time?
Okay. Well, I think you've had some pretty good information about how telomere length can change and what some of the factors might be. And maybe just take a step back and say that if we measured everyone's telomere length in this room, and it looks like there's an age range that maybe goes from 30 to 60 plus, let's say.
12. My daughter's 12.
We would get a very clear relationship between your real age and your telomere length. And but what is interesting is that if you take a very narrow age range, whether, you know, and there's been studies that go right back to a big collection of newborn individuals and centenarians, but at any given decade, let's say, there'll be quite a bit of variation between individuals in their telomere length. But on average, there's almost inexorable decrease in telomere length. I probably shouldn't give the units because it won't mean much to most people, but it declines, not quite linearly. There's a big decline early in life because there's a lot of cell division and telomere loss is associated with cell division. It then is a slower rate of decline, let's say from 20 to 80, and then from 80 on, it's a little bit less clear what actually happens. In some studies, it looks like it might plateau, and centenarians have sort of had a better telomere maintenance mechanism than perhaps others who are dying in their 50s, 60s, 70s. Other studies sometimes show that the very old individuals may be losing telomeres faster, and yet other studies show it may be increasing. So there could be very sort of idiosyncratic factors at play depending upon what centenarian population is examined. So we used to think that with age, telomere length would decline pretty much in all of us all the time, just another year, another birthday, slightly shorter telomeres. But some of the work that my UCSF colleagues have done themselves, and it's been replicated in other studies, quite clearly shows that telomere length isn't just a simple monotonic decreasing metric. It can actually stay stable over a fairly long period of time, like years, or it can show faster than normal telomere loss, sometimes quite dramatic. And in some individuals, over a 1 or 2 year period or longer, it might actually be increasing. And we don't fully understand all of the factors that contribute to that difference between individuals, but it could well be that a number of these factors that have been discussed, diet, exercise, whether you de-stress your life, whether you have a good social network and you don't have as much perceived stress, those probably are all factors, but very likely, as Zhu Lin mentioned, there's a lot of genetic factors. So other aspects of the genome may be contributing to our personal telomere dynamics. Now, I want to take this opportunity, since I'm now talking about telomere length measurements, to give a disclosure that there is a commercial interest here, except for Thea. Alyssa, Zhu, and I, and our colleague Elizabeth Blackburn, co-founded a company to measure telomere length last June. We're actively pursuing multiple different aspects of health and wellness, and in the future we'll be looking at actual medical applications of telomere length measurements. So I'm not pitching the company. I did work at UCSF. I was a postdoc with Herb Boyer, the founder of Genentech, back in the 80s, but I was never on faculty at UCSF. So after Jero and I co-founded this company with Liz, Alyssa, and Zhu, and I'm currently the head scientist, and our CEO is sitting there, Dan Hunt. So I just wanted to mention that so it's clear there is a commercial interest in measuring telomere length, but we hope to have the best quality telomere length measurements and actually be able to, in individuals, ultimately look at telomere dynamics, which we think is going to be probably more important than what your telomere length is today.
Thank you. And I have to apologize. I said UCSF earlier. I took it out of the bio and I left it in the heading, so I was on autopilot, so I apologize again for that. Thea, you mentioned perceived stress in your book. What does that mean?
Yeah, we've all been talking a lot about perceived stress. And the studies that Liz and Alyssa and Zhu have done are looking at perceived stress, how each of us perceives our circumstances. When you think about it, there's really no such thing as objective stress. Obviously, there are particular circumstances we could point to where everybody would say, yes, that's extremely stressful. But how each of us reacts is really up to us. It's how we choose to interpret a particular circumstance. I could be sitting in a traffic jam and tearing out my hair, and Cal could be sitting there and, you know, humming a tune. So there are things that we can do to change our perceptions of what is going on in our lives. The way that I like to look at it is that the good kind of stress is challenge stress. It's when we face a challenge, you know, your Juliet waiting in the wings to come on stage to meet your Romeo. Then there's threat stress. That's the bad stress. That's the chronic stress, the one where we feel overwhelmed, we feel out of control. And what I talk a lot about in the book is ways that we can really try to change our perceptions of our circumstances from being a circumstance of threat to a circumstance of challenge. I want to read just a few. I have a lot of tests in the book, and kind of the primary test when I talk about the work of the great folks at UCSF is the perceived stress scale, and that really lies at the heart of a lot of these studies. And I just want to read some of the questions that are there. For instance, in the last month, how often have you been upset because of something that happened unexpectedly? How often have you felt that you were unable to control the important things in your life? How often have you felt nervous and stressed? In the last month, how often have you been angered because of things that were outside of your control? Control is a huge issue in terms of how whether we think that we're in a whether we're experiencing challenge stress or threat stress. So these are the kinds of questions that really make a difference when people are trying, when scientists are trying to assess how people observe their environments, and that's really at the heart of everything. It's not, oh, you know, I live in Boston, we had a snowstorm, my pipes burst. Obviously, that's incredibly stressful. But there's a way I might be able to deal with that would be more mindful, and somebody else might not be able to do that. So it's how we look at the events in our lives.
Great. Alyssa, I know you have a particular interest in caregivers. How does caregiving affect health, and what do you suggest for caregivers?
It'll be challenging to condense that answer. So I do have this is a question close to my heart. We do know that caregivers sometimes even die before the person they're caregiving for. It's tremendously stressful. It's a 24/7 job. We know caregivers have suppressed immune systems. Their wounds heal slower. If they also report feeling strained, that they don't have enough resources, they tend to die in about 60% more quickly than caregivers who are not feeling that strain. So caregivers are really important to our society. Many of us have been parental caregivers. We might be caring for aging parents. That's doing both at the same time as the sandwich generation. And it's important to, number one, recognize that you are under more stress than other people, and you need to be stress resilient. So I have a few tips for caregivers that I would give them to be stress resilient. So I think number one is to acknowledge the one predictable thing in your life is that your day will be unpredictable, that there will be events that will happen that are probably outside of your control. And so you need to ask yourself, how am I going to respond right now? How am I going to respond tomorrow? You get to practice over and over stress resilience. So in a way, it's quite an ultimate challenge to live with caregiving. So number one is, you know, Thea talked about the stress response in our primitive brain, and we're pretty hardwired to react with a huge fight-flight response when something threatening happens. And sometimes that initial stress response is uncontrollable, but what we can do is become aware of our stress response. And so we turn on our awareness and observe our responses. So what do we need to do? How can we do that in the moment when things are unfolding? Number one, you need to keep breathing. None of us are breathing. We rarely breathe fully and slowly enough to really give our brain the oxygen we need. To slow down that stress response, we need to focus on our breathing and then focus and become aware of our body and our thoughts. So you can watch the stress response, and you can laugh at it and say, that's the primitive part of my brain, but I'm not going to let it go on and on and on. So there are a couple things we can do. Number one is reflections, not ruminations. So we want to be aware of the thoughts we're having, and rather than kind of pushing them away or being panicked by them, you can label your emotions, fear, anxiety, stress, sadness, and notice if you are continuing the stress. After the event happens, we tend to continue to be stressed, and that's just thought stress. So notice thought stress. Thought stress might be worrying about what's going to happen next, or it might be reliving the stressful event, replaying it, going over in your mind, things that have already happened. So becoming aware of our thoughts is really it's necessary for stress reduction, but not sufficient. One of the things that caregivers need to do is to take time out of their day for themselves. So for caregivers, their needs come last. And you might ask yourself, how much time do I need each day for myself, just for myself? That self-care might be exercise, yoga, meditation, talking to someone, being alone. How much time do you need? Is it 30 minutes? Is it 2 hours? And take that time out, because if you can't care for yourself, you can't care for others as well. Adding positive emotion to your life, for positive events that happen that we might ignore. We don't tend to ruminate on the positive, but more on the negative. But we can ruminate on the positive. We call that savoring. At the end of your day, think about something positive that happened and relive that, and you get another burst of positive emotion. And I can tell you, your telomerase is probably listening to that. We know it's listening to stress. A last thing I want to say to caregivers and to all of us is to recognize exercise as a buffer to stress. So we've shown, for example, that people under a lot of stress have shorter telomeres, but if they're exercising vigorously, they don't. So the exercise is buffering them from stress-induced telomere shortening. So that stress-telomere shortening relationship we find mostly in sedentary people. And for caregivers, exercise is just not optional. You need exercise. And I guess another point would be, and probably on a daily basis, at least something active, because stress management and stress resilience is a daily management task. It's not something you do on the weekend or when you have time or when you get to go on vacation to Hawaii.
Zhu, what is the status of telomere research today?
Wow, that's a very big question. Yeah. I think I would just give my 2 cents. You know, many labs using model organisms to study telomere minutes and the fundamental mechanisms of how telomeres are regulated during development and disease progression using yeast, for example, plants and mice, you know, or just using cells from human. So that's one aspect of it. Obviously, we talked about how genes and environment and lifestyle factors could influence telomere length and telomere maintenance. And I think finding out how genes interact with each other and genes interact with your lifestyle factors and your environment and work together to influence telomere length, and in turn, how telomere length could affect your health or, you know, affect disease, and how we can take that information to improve our health and improve disease diagnostics, therapeutics. So these are all huge questions that really would, I see, you know, big progress ahead. I talked about the Kaiser Project, where we are measuring 100,000 Kaiser Permanente patients' telomere length. And I also mentioned that for these same patients, we have genome-wide SNP analysis. In addition to that, Kaiser Permanente patients has a rich electronic medical record, as well as environmental factor data about these patients' neighborhood characteristics, where they live, the population density, whether they have access to parks, to grocery, their air pollution, the water quality. So after we acquire data from this huge population and analyze it, I'm sure we will learn a lot about telomere maintenance and how that's related to our health. So actually, I wanted to mention that several of my Kaiser colleagues are here in the audience today, so I'm just very excited to see them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. David and Diane and Mary and there's another.
Okay, Calvin, how do we get our telomere length tested, and how is it done?
Yeah, well, I can talk about what goes on at Telome Health. And in terms of getting it tested, we're currently supporting a fair number of research studies, largely with academic groups, but also with some corporate partners, in order to further characterize the benefit of telomere length measurements in different health and wellness settings. And our website will launch later this month, and we plan to have on that a number of educational pieces which will list some of the research studies that are being done, hopefully a fair number locally, but also in other parts of the country. And there may be some of you who might wish to see if you can participate in some of those. We're excited about the new findings that will arise from these studies, and whether you participate or not, we'll have these posted on our website as they come in. Now, we're also thinking that it may be possible for individuals who participate in these studies to opt into a program for multiple telomere length testing, where we may be able to give the telomere length to individuals after certain regulatory guidelines are taken care of. So in terms of how the telomere length test is actually done, we're using a extremely well-established and patented technology, which has been used in the vast majority of the large epidemiological studies that have been conducted around the world. This is called the qPCR, or quantitative polymerase chain reaction, another Nobel Prize-winning technology assay for telomere length. It was discovered by Richard Cawthon at the University of Utah. Our company has the exclusive license to that technology, and the technology itself was further improved by Dr. Lin and colleagues at UCSF, and that's the technology which we believe will be dominant and the most cost-effective and highest quality assay for these large studies. In terms of the subject, the process is relatively painless. It involves collecting just a single tube of blood, having it frozen under appropriate conditions, and shipped to our company. It's also possible that in the future you may be able to provide just a saliva sample. There are commercial kits available now they're called spit kits, and they're spit parties where people send their saliva, which contains immune cells, to a company for genetic analysis, and we are looking at that currently for telomere length testing as well.
That was the last official question, so we're going to do question and answers now, and I would ask that when you ask a question, we'll be passing around a microphone, if you would please limit it to one part question. I know it's tempting to go into a second and a third part, but please limit it to one part question, and we are going to, you ask your question, and we're going to let the panelists look at each other and decide who's going to answer it. Okay, thank you.
If you're measuring telomere length in blood, is that similar in all body tissues, or is there a disparity?
Cal, why don't you take that one?
Yeah, so it turns out that the white blood cells represent largely immune cells, but other types of cells as well, and they're essentially a surrogate marker of what's going on elsewhere. If you have disease in the liver, or you have a lung disease, or if you have cancer, it's going to impact the immune system. It's going to show up typically as shorter telomeres in that individual compared to normals. There have been comparisons. If you take skin fibroblasts, for example, a particular type of skin cell, or buccal cells from the inside of the cheek, you don't get exactly the same telomere length measurement, but within an individual, there's a very high degree of correlation. If your immune cells are short, you're going to have shorter telomeres than most other tissues in the body.
Thank you. I want, before we have the next question, I apologize. Thea's book, Stress Less, which is incredible, you really need to all read it, is available in the room out here. And if there's a if it's sold out before you get out there, Thea will sign a little, they call it a packet or something. It's a sticker.
Oh.
And then they put it on in the book, and they ship it to you for no cost. So if they're out of books, please order your book, and it will be shipped to you for no shipping fee. Thank you.
Just a very simple question. In stem cell therapy, the new cells that are made from the stem cells, what is the relationship of the telomeres on that to the telomeres in the body?
Okay. Yeah, I'll take that one. Having worked at Geron, which focuses on stem cell therapies as well as telomerase, I can answer that question. It turns out that in most stem cell compartments, telomeres are longer than they are in the more differentiated tissues. And if you're looking at human embryonic stem cells, for example, they're longer still. They undergo the same telomere loss, so stem cells, whether they're from an adult or for embryonic tissue, you will see telomere shortening as well. And one of the applications that we're thinking about and others in the research community is, does shorter telomeres in a cell therapy that's going to be transplanted, whether it's autologous or between individuals, predict the telomere length in that graft, predict the success of the graft? And there's some evidence now that suggests that it will.
I'd like to add something to that, just regarding a study. It hasn't been published yet, that one of Robert Sapolsky, he's at Stanford, one of his graduate students did, that was really fascinating regarding neural stem cells and stress. And what they did was they took mice who were pregnant, and they had a control group, and they had a group that they were stressing, mild stress, mild chronic stress. And then the pups were born, and astonishingly what they found was in the pups who were born of the stressed moms that the telomeres of their neural stem cells were shorter than those of the pups of the moms who had not been stressed. So it's kind of horrifying and fascinating at once that, there can be that kind of an effect.
And I should add that our colleagues at Irvine in a collaboration have found the same thing with humans in terms of if people had stress when they were in the womb, so they interviewed their mom and found out what was going on in their life, they have shorter telomeres as adults in blood.
Those are the leukocytes.
Yes, yeah. In the blood, not in the brain.
Not the stem.
We don't know what's happening in the brain.
Right. So with rats, you can decapitate them and look and see what's going on. No, seriously. So you can see what's going on. You can,
can't do that in people.
Can't do that with people yet. Thank God.
Hi. I was just wondering if you could elaborate on that really interesting link between feeling present. I realize it's an unpublished study. And how that feeling present on your telomeres, but how that would also relate to perceived stress. Because you're aware of these emotions, but if you're present in the moment, it doesn't correlate with shorter telomeres. If you could just elaborate on that.
It's a great question. I don't have a simple answer, but one of the main techniques we teach people to manage perceived stress is mindfulness training, so the skill of paying attention to the present moment and being aware of your emotions, being able to label them. It leads to just better emotion regulation. So it's easy to be chronically stressed, not even notice, and just let the stress response go awry. And when you are being mindful of your body, your breathing, your perceived stress, that process almost disappears. The perceived stress, you might be aware of it, but it's not going to necessarily be triggering your cortisol and causing the fight-flight response.
I heard mentioned that when a person is stressed that they want to eat a whole lot more. My experience all my life has been just the opposite.
Well,
I have lost appetite.
Yeah, I'm like that as well. I'm a person who, when I'm extremely stressed, I don't eat. More people, I can't remember exactly what the percentage is, but the majority of people, when they're stressed, eat. People are stress eaters. But then there's this other group where when they're stressed, they don't eat. And that could be because, your stomach essentially gets tied up in knots, and so you don't feel like eating. But I fall into that same category. It's not one or the other, but it is more common that people will reach for food and reach for sweet, fatty, crunchy foods when they are stressed.
Well, why does omega-3 increase the length of the telomere?
Well, what they found was that there was a correlation. It wasn't a question of a cause and effect. Now, there could be a cause and effect, and I'm going to let Cal maybe speak a little to that if you'd like to. What they found in this particular study was that the longer telomeres correlated with those with the higher levels of omega-3. They weren't drawing a causal link. But I don't know, as far as biochemistry goes, does anybody have a response to that?
So the omega-3 fatty acids are involved in the inflammation response, and generally it's thought that omega-3s will reduce inflammation, and inflammation, as we heard, can increase telomere loss. I'm not exactly sure. Maybe Alyssa or Dr. Lin knows about the relationship to telomerase and inflammation. But generally, if you can reduce, especially chronic inflammation, then you'll slow the rate of telomere loss. That hasn't been causally examined in humans, but in cellular studies, it's been shown that there are certain cytokines that can accelerate telomere loss. So if you can dampen those, you'll actually have a net effect of increasing telomere length relative to the chronically stressed person.
The panel gave some very good suggestions on how to reduce stress in your life, like not thinking of past events or forecasting future events and thinking very positive, but you know, the brain's going to do 90% of what you don't want them to do. How do you get people to change their thought patterns and to actually do what you're recommending they do? What do me and other people have to do rather than just hear you say it?
Well, it's a great question, and I think changing human behavior and thought patterns is one of the most challenging issues facing public health today. Most of our chronic diseases are diseases of lifestyle and behavior. Cardiovascular disease, diabetes, obesity, they're not necessarily, the genetics is very fuzzy and a small contribution. So we are also genetically prone to have different thought styles, and some of us are more prone to rumination and depression and anxiety, and others are not. So there are different ways for stress reduction. I think of it as, stress is the study of individual differences, and for stress reduction, there's no one, one glove fits all. So at Osher Center, we're trying out several different interventions, and one of them, we have an intervention for obese pregnant women, and we're trying to reduce the transmission of both stress and obesity to their offspring. And we're testing mindful eating and mindfulness training and comparing that to Laurel Mellon's more active coping intervention called emotional brain training, where there's a lot of check-ins and kind of active regulation of emotion rather than awareness and acceptance. So they're kind of opposite. And both of them will probably work really well, and they're very different psychological mechanisms. One trying to gain control and actively regulate, another trying to observe and accept how we are in the moment. So for me, it's got to be physical, intense exercise or power flow yoga. Even though I'm a cognitive person, it's body up, and that helps me a lot. So for other people, it's more top down and other types of different therapy or I guess the class that's probably helped the most people is called mindfulness-based stress reduction. And this is, we use a lot of techniques from this program in our interventions at Osher to teach people different ways to be both mindful of stress and live mindfully and check into their hunger and mood before they eat so they're eating mindfully and enjoying the food and being really conscious of the experience.
I'd like to add just a little to that. There, I do talk about some studies in my book. There are ways, and Alyssa had mentioned this when she was talking, where you're essentially stress-proofing your brain. I mean, there have been studies that show, for instance, a woman named Naomi Eisenberg did this really interesting study at UCLA where she was looking at social support, and she had people track how much social support they had prior to prior to her putting them into a brain scan and scanning their brains. And what she found, and then once they were in the scan, after this period of time where they tracked their levels of social support, she involved them in, it wasn't a video game, but it was essentially a game where they thought they'd be an equal partner, but in fact they weren't. So they were experiencing a rejection experience. And what they found looking at the brain scans was that those who had more social support, that their brain actually reacted differently, that their pain center, which is the same center that lights up when you have physical pain and emotional pain, was less reactive than those who had not had the social support. They had thought that what they would find was that the prefrontal cortex, where, you know, impulse control, that would be taking over. But what they found instead was that their brains were actually less reactive. So there are things, and exercise is another thing you can do to actually, there have been many studies with animals, for instance, showing that you can stress-proof the brain, so it's not a one-to-one correspondence. When you're in the stressful circumstance, you necessarily have this means of coping, although that's wonderful too, but that you've actually stress-proofed your brain, so you're going to react differently.
I'm trying to get a feel for the time frame. How quickly could I start damaging my telomeres? Say I have an acute life stressor, but it's a child gets sick, but it lasts for a long time, and there's a lot of uncertainty. Or how quickly could I start improving my telomeres?
All right, I guess that's me. that's a great question, and we haven't mapped out all the kinetics to give you a detailed answer. But here's what we know: in our studies of caregiving moms, we found that there was this correlation with the years of caregiving or the years since diagnosis and how short their telomeres were. But once you got to about 8 years, almost all of those women had short telomeres. So there is a slow and long wear and tear process through the years. So there's much more scatter in the first few years of caregiving, and some people still have long telomeres. We don't know how quickly one can change their telomeres. Our best guess is, if you're doing an intervention, maybe 4 to 6 months. So we're starting to look in the time frame of every 6 months. Our current studies on mothers of children with autism, and we're going in every 6 months and trying to really understand that, how the state of mind, that question of trying to understand how mindfulness and perceived stress are really working in daily life, and how that's related to their telomerase. So the telomerase is something that can change within minutes. We thought telomerase was going to be stable and slow changing. We know that in cells you can zap them with, you know, a stressor like UV, and the telomerase goes up immediately, or with oxidative stress. So recently we did a study, a lab stressor for people. We brought them into the lab. We made them give a speech in front of an unfriendly audience. Cortisol shoots up, but telomerase shot up too. So an hour after this stress exposure, telomerase had increased about 30%. So telomerase is stress reactive. It changes quickly, and it's probably, you know, the message to the body is there's a threat out there that, you know, whether it's a psychological threat or an antigen, the body doesn't necessarily differentiate the two that much, and telomerase is increasing to protect those chromosomes. So we think telomerase changes on a daily basis, even though part of when we measure telomerase is, you know, reflecting long-term health. Part of it is also, how stressed were you in the last hour?
Are studies being done of returning veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder?
Yes. So we're currently, Owen Wolkowitz is leading some of those studies, and we are looking at some of the millennium cohorts. Some of these large cohorts are being followed of veterans and with and without PTSD. And we recently published a study on post-traumatic stress disorder showing that men and women with PTSD did have shorter telomeres. What was so interesting about that was that when we looked at early life trauma, that actually explained most of the story. So the people with early life trauma had the shortest telomeres. And when we kind of covariated for that or took that away, that difference between PTSD and non-PTSD was almost gone. So we think a lot of our human health, adult health, is shaped by our childhood and early trauma, and also our prenatal experience. We know that now.
When you, and I'm segueing into this, on your comments about prenatal experience. And if one is born to a mother who's very stressed during the pregnancy and starts out at a deficit, and one eventually works and tries to do all the things that you've spoken about to reduce stress, is there going to be a difference in length of life or in quality of life or in neither?
Now, I would love to know the answer to that wonderful question. That's a research study. we are looking at how much the mother transmits telomere length to the baby and how much her stress and obesity and depression might be shaping the baby's telomere length. But we do know that telomere length in even in late life, in one of our studies, we measured telomere length in healthy 70-year-olds, and how many base pairs they lost over the next 2 years predicted earlier mortality for the men. So even in short periods, our rate of change matters, and even later in life. So telomere length is associated with longevity, and telomere length change is as well, our rate of change.
Last question?
Yeah, I have a question about whether or not a stressed person is medicated, and if they're being treated for that stress, and if that medication or treatment helps with the effect on telomeres.
So this is another question we wish we had a great answer to. As peeking at all the data and studies we've done, it looks like antidepressants are very protective. We know they're protective to the brain cells and promote neurogenesis. We think they also might help protect telomerase. And in fact, in our current studies, we're having to turn away our caregiving moms who are on antidepressants because we think that would be a huge confound, and we wouldn't be able to look at anything else because these medications might have such big effects. Same with statins. Statins are anti-inflammatory.
Great. Well, thank you. Our thanks today to Thea Singer, Dr. Zhu Lin, Dr. Calvin Harley, and Dr. Lisa Appel for their comments here today. We also thank our audience here as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 108th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.